This is a podcast from The Red House, the former home of Benjamin Britten and Peter Piers. I'm Lucy Walker. Join me, colleagues and other guests for a monthly chat about all things Britten and Piers, plus music, culture, heritage in general, and anything else that might come up. Welcome to the From the Red House podcast. And this is the last podcast in series two, going out shortly before Christmas. And I'm really thrilled to be joined by Anna Lapwood. Hello, Anna.
Hello, lovely to be here.
Lovely to have you on the show. And I've been really interested in reading about your extraordinary career to date. So perhaps you'd like to just say who you are and broadly speaking, what it is that you do.
Yes, so I work as the director of music at Pembroke College in Cambridge, and I've been there since I was 21. So this is my fifth year now, which is very, very bizarre. But it's part of my job there. I run the choirs. So we have a chapel choir and also a girls' choir for girls age 11 to 18. But alongside that, I also play the organ and travel around the place doing organ recitals and things like that, and also do a little bit of broadcasting as well. So it's quite busy, but it's a nice sort of selection of things.
Yes, that's one of those mixed portfolio jobs that always sort of must be really, you have to be quite organised, I should think, to keep on top of all that. But I assume it gives you energy back and you keep going as a result
it does of that. And I think everything feeds into everything else, so if I'm doing an organ recital, I will often think about something we've talked about in a choir practice or something that one of the girls has said to me in a choir practice, and it all ties in and kind of ties into this broad portfolio of who I am as a musician and as a person as well.
You started at 21, which is extraordinarily young, and I'm sure people say this to you all the time, and I don't want to come across like your kind of grandmother here, but it is kind of a fact worth just drawing attention to. How did that come about that you came to be doing that quite so young?
Well, I'd been the organ scholar at Magdalen College in Oxford, and actually before that I was a harpist, so I came to the organ quite late, but did this organ scholarship, got to the end, and as is so often the case, I think, when you come to the end of a university degree, I went, oh gosh, I have nothing planned, and started applying for jobs and didn't get a couple of jobs and was thinking, oh gosh, nothing's going to happen. And then a colleague of mine, one of my very good friends, pointed out the Pembroke job and just said, oh well, have you thought about going for this? And I thought, oh, don't be silly, there's absolutely no way I'll get that, but decided to apply for it for the experience. And then the more I researched the job and researched the college, I just thought, gosh, actually this could be something really exciting. And sure enough, I ended up getting it, and they've been incredible. I mean, not only have they let me sort of learn on the job and guided me in the right direction, but they've also let me do all my organ playing and broadcasting and everything like that. So I feel extremely lucky that I've sort of landed in this tailor-made job.
That is remarkable. Some Cambridge colleges have kind of characteristics around them that people associate with them. And what's Pembroke's kind of thing, if it has one?
I think it's incredibly friendly, and I'm sure every college would say that, but having been at Magdalen, which is also quite a friendly college but a much larger college, and then moving to Pembroke, which is quite small, quite intimate, there definitely is this real sense of community. And we, like, our organ scholar runs these Disney sing-alongs and things like that, and the whole college gets involved. And a couple of weeks ago we did carol singing in the court because we couldn't sing inside, and it is just a wonderful community spirit, and everyone supports everyone else, which I really enjoy.
Wonderful. The transition from harp to organ is quite an interesting one. What brought that about, do you think?
That's a bit of a sore point, almost. Well, not a sore point, but it's one of those decisions that I still occasionally think, oh gosh, was that really the right thing to do? Because I was completely set on being a harpist. I absolutely adored it. I was studying at the Junior Royal Academy and had this amazing harp teacher who actually has a house in Alborough. She's Miriam Keough, and we got on really well. And I just thought, right, this is what I want to do. And then I ended up taking up the organ in my last couple of years at school, because I loved taking up different instruments and seeing how they interacted. And I had been thinking about conservatoire versus university and was assuming I was going to do conservatoire, but then got really interested in the university course at Oxford, and the idea of an organ scholarship was kind of put in my direction. I think the fact that I heard organ scholars got a grand piano in their room was a little bit of an incentive, although I never actually got one, I'm afraid to say. But So I sort of thought, oh, well, maybe this is something I could do, but had no idea whether I'd be able to get one. And then ended up playing to the director of music at Magdalen, who said, oh, you should apply here. And I really didn't know what that meant at all. I was like, oh, lovely, someone wants me, good. And applied and got it. And it ended up being completely transformative. I mean, you're playing for 8 services a week as an organ scholar at Magdalen. So different music every single day, rehearsing the boys at 7:50 every morning. Mm. And it was the most immersive education in choral music, essentially. I went from having never accompanied a choir on the organ before to accompanying literally every day. But it meant I had to make the choice to stop the harp, which I still am slightly sad about, but I now just absolutely adore the organ, so that's good.
How interesting. It seems to be something you're drawn to and really like to grasp, is kind of learning on the job. So just plunging in and seeing how it goes. But being very supported in doing it but just grasping that challenge as well.
I think I'd never thought about it like that before, but I guess that is probably correct, yes.
The world of organ playing and choral scholarship and choral conducting, obviously, which is what you do as well, has historically been a very male world. Are you still in the minority of female organ players, female choral conductors?
Yes, I think so. I mean, there's a fab organisation that has been set up in the last couple of years called the Society of Women Organists. And what I love about that, actually, is it makes everyone just that little bit more visible and links us all up. So we realise that there are other female organists out there, and we have sort of socials and things like that. And there are the blog posts and all of this. And that's a wonderful place for female organists to turn, I think, to have a bit of a support network. Mm-hmm. We are definitely in the minority still, I think it is on the rise. I think the influx of girls choirs in the last sort of 20 years or so, it feels like that is starting to push through into organ playing as well, because it's such an obvious way for girls to realise that the organ is something they might want to study and might want to think about doing as a career. Mm-hmm. Conductors, I think, again, it feels like we're on the rise, but directors of music in Cambridge, I think 3 of them are female out of, what, 20-something. Mm-hmm. So there's still a way to go.
Yes, but you're doing your bit to, as you say, encourage that yourself with having sessions for girls playing the organ as well, and sort of giving them taster days and that kind of thing.
Yes, so we run this organ experience for girls, where we basically have 40 girls and we take over the Cambridge chapels. And that's all about making them feel as if they are welcome in those spaces. Because I think if you take a chapel like King's or John's, they're such huge, imposing spaces. Mm. And why would you, as an 11-year-old girl, think that you could one day be working there and belong there? So the idea is we just go in and let them try it out and let them play their piano pieces on the organ and try and just make them really excited. But similarly with my girls' choir, I've seen this term we've been in a different venue. We've been rehearsing in a church across the road from Pembroke, and the organ console is right next to them when they're singing. And it's been wonderful to watch, because when the organist plays his voluntary, they all sit down and they are absolutely transfixed. They sit there watching his feet and their mouths are wide open, and now they all want to learn the organ, and I'm trying to figure out how on earth I can make that happen.
Yes, you're kind of like almost the opposite problem. No, it's funny you're saying that they're trying out their piano pieces on the organ, because I'm a pianist and occasionally I've had to go on the organ, and just that extraordinary feeling of you're playing something on a keyboard and it coming out somewhere else spatially and this immense volume, I used to find it very disconcerting, and I just sort of I can't cope with this, I need to have more control over the sound, and I found it oddly sort of intimidating, but I love listening to it. It's got tremendous power. Does it feel powerful when you're actually on the console?
It does, it really does. And actually, it's so funny. Often I'll have been playing a recital or something and I'll come down and I'm quite short. I'm only 5'3". And particularly if I'm wearing my organ shoes, I look even shorter. And the audience members will often say to me, how on earth do you make such a big sound as such a small person? And I sort of have to try and explain that it's really nothing to do with me. I'm just pressing buttons. It is an amazing feeling. Mm. And there's nothing better than having a huge cathedral or church to yourself and just being able to fill that entire building through pressing one key. It's really exciting.
No, I can fully believe that. Just sidebar there. Tell me about organ shoes.
Oh gosh. So we have special shoes to play the organ because obviously we're playing a whole keyboard with our feet. And it's laid out exactly the same as a normal piano keyboard, but with obviously slightly larger keys, more in proportion to a foot. And it is a little bit like a ballet character shoe. So it's got quite a high heel, maybe, I don't know, 3 inches or so. And it's also got suede on the bottom. So it allows you to slip easily over the keys. And it's basically the opposite of ballet shoes in that respect, in that ballet shoes, you try and make them as sticky as possible so that you don't slip. With organ shoes, you want to be able to move as smoothly and freely as possible. So you're sort of dancing over the keys at the same time. And that's part of what makes it really fun, I think. Mm.
Goodness, yes, I didn't realise there was such a thing, but that, of course, makes perfect sense. Was it this year you were going to come to the Aldbrough Festival with your arrangement of Britain's Four Sea Interludes? Was that going to have been this year? Yeah, so really sorry not to have heard that, in obviously the festival not happening, but that must have been a great project to go about arranging these orchestral pieces for organ. Is that something you do a lot of?
It's something that I've started getting really interested in the last couple of years. I think partly because of the fact that I started as a harpist and came through the orchestral world. So I actually played the Four Sea Interludes, I think, 3 times while I was at school. Mm-hmm. And the last time was with the National Youth Orchestra, and John Wilson was conducting. And he basically turned it into a piece of film music. It was so exciting. And so I've loved those pieces for such a long time. And I just thought, well, hang on a minute, these could be quite interesting on the organ. And then Aldbrough Festival approached me and asked me to do a concert featuring Britain's organ works. Now, there are only a couple of sort of proper organ works written by Britain. Mm. And so I was thinking, what else could I include? And it seemed like the perfect opportunity. And then obviously the recital got cancelled. So I ended up finishing the transcription over lockdown. It was a really lovely lockdown project. I think there's basically no better way to get to know an orchestral score than to think about transcribing it and to have to look at it in so much detail and prioritise and listen to lots of recordings and think, right, well, which bit do we really need to hear there to create the overall effect of a full orchestra?
Yes, and heard your transcription of Dawn. I think you put that up the other day. It's absolutely lovely. It works absolutely brilliantly. Very atmospheric. And different but recognisable at the same time. So it is like a kind of radical interpretation of the orchestral piece. I really liked it. Do you have something else on the go, orchestral?
Well, actually, I'm recording the Britain. I'm making a CD in January. The Britain Estate have very kindly agreed to me recording it, and Boosey and Hawkes are going to publish it. So that's kind of the big thing, is getting the transcription recording ready, as opposed to just for my own sake or for a recital's sake ready. But no, I haven't thought of a next project yet. Maybe I need to think of that today.
And I also saw you on an arrangement of the Debussy String Quartet, which was lovely.
Well, that's also going on the CD. So the CD is the Britain, Debussy, Ravel, Tombeau de Couperin. So a lot of transcriptions. And actually a transcription I've done of Messiaen's Vocalise, which is originally for a solo singer without any text and piano. Mm. So translates beautifully onto the organ, because you can have the feet as the solo singer. It sounds a little bit weird to say, doesn't it? But it does work really quite well.
Oh, wow. And Messiaen, of course, so full of organ music himself.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Are you drawn to 20th century repertoire especially, or is that just happens to be on that disc?
I think I am. I think I enjoy the sound world. I mean, I should say about Britain that I'm particularly drawn to him because my dad grew up in Suffolk, and we used to spend most of our family holidays at Snape. And my dad actually worked with Britain when he was a teenager. So he was playing in Noah's Flood and playing first violin, and a hand tapped him on the shoulder and said, "Very well done." And he turned around, and it was Britain. So he's one of those composers that has followed me all the way through, and I've always been obsessed with his music. But yeah, in general, I love 20th century and 21st century. I love working directly with composers and talking to them about how I can best convey their ideas to an audience.
Do you find yourself giving them tutorials on what works and what doesn't work at all for composers who aren't so familiar with the organ?
Yeah, I think it's only kind. It would be mean to just... I mean, I'm actually... I'm working with Stainer and Bell at the moment to commission 12 new pieces of organ music by female composers. So we're putting together an anthology based on de Messier's 12 chorale preludes on Gregorian chant. The idea being that this music can be easily introduced into recitals, but also into the church year. And it's fascinating because obviously some of these people just haven't written for the organ before. And I've got a meeting in a couple of weeks' time where I'm taking one of the composers to an organ and we're just sitting there and I guess messing around and just looking at all these different colours and what works and what doesn't, because it is a bit different to the piano.
Indeed.
Just a bit.
Just a bit. There's a film that you made with Classic FM. I don't know when that was. It's on your website, where you talk about you were going through an extraordinary period of travelling, seemingly across the globe in a week or something, and it was kind of a very busy time. That's obviously all off at the moment. Mm. How, apart from being able to transcribe the 4C interludes, how has lockdown been for you as a performing musician?
It's been really tough. I think the thing I've missed most, I guess, is my work with the choirs, because normally I'm working with these people very closely every week, and there's nothing quite like walking into a room and a group of people all breathing in together and then producing sound that's unified. So I think I almost missed that more than performing as such. I think the good thing about lockdown is that it's meant that I have been able to really sit and practice in a way that I simply don't have time to do normally. And it just so happened that I ended up doing my first Radio 3 recital 2 weeks ago now. And so I don't know if I'd have been able to do that without that space and clear diary and clear headspace almost to be able to sit and just practice for 6-7 hours a day.
Yes. Yeah. So the musicians I've spoken to have had that kind of curious push-pull relationship to lockdown, that great disappointment and missing people, the social side of being absolutely being in a room and being able to experience live music, but at the same time it's put the brakes on a bit and it's given them, as you say, headspace and a bit and valuable practice time, but you presumably wouldn't choose to repeat it in any
again. Well, also, I mean, I live by myself and you sort of don't realise quite how much you do rely on human interaction and human touch in order to just get through every day. And it's a weird thing. I realized that the only living thing that I touched in a month was my plants. I now have many, many plants thanks to lockdown, but it is very odd. I don't think I would repeat it, but I do think it's worth saying that so many musicians live their lives at a million miles an hour and are constantly kind of bouncing from one gig to the next, learning. I mean, I was talking to an opera singer recently who was saying that she will always be singing in opera and learning three more at the same time.
It's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, it's crazy. And so I think it has been good for a lot of us to just take a step back and think, what is really important?
Yes. And then I suppose through next year there'll be, optimistically, this slow return to at least some semblance of what things used to be. So, you know, here's to that.
Fingers crossed.
Yes. I'm not going to harp on your age, but it's an interesting thing.
Harp pun, by the way.
Oh, how about that? Just punning without even realizing it now. That's really worrying. Yes, so just on your the fact of you being in your 20s and being a classical musician and using social media in a very skillful way is something that a lot of classical musicians are, not all are doing it, but most are choosing to do it as a form of networking, promotion, getting to know people. I mean, I contacted you via Twitter because we've not even actually met. Do you find you can use it in a way that works for you?
It's interesting. So I think I started using social media as a work tool probably about 5 years ago. In fact, probably just before I started at Cambridge. And a lot of my colleagues and friends said, oh, no, stop that. Don't do that. It's embarrassing. You can't talk about your work. It's the wrong thing. Just get on and do it and people will notice you. And I sort of thought, well, I'm not so sure about that. People seem to be interested in seeing what an organist actually does, because organists are obviously usually hidden away and are a bit of a mystery. So trying to demystify that a little bit seemed like something quite fun. And I'm 100% certain that I wouldn't be doing a lot of what I'm doing now were it not for Twitter and social networks. Having said that, I do also think that they can take over your lives a little, and I always try and limit how much time I spend on it in any given day and have a little timer and things like that. But I think it is a very positive thing.
I think it is, and I think classical music Twitter on the whole is a reasonably friendly space. I hope it is anyway for those of you who sort of use it more. But
Also, I think, I mean, you talk about gender equality in the choral world and the organ world, and I think the only way we can increase that equality is for them to have very visible role models. And to be perfectly honest, the people we're looking at aren't even using Twitter anymore. They're on TikTok. I don't even know how to get started on TikTok, so I'm not going to try. But although my girls have tried to convince me to do that. But I do think like that is the way to make them potentially see themselves as doing that in the future. You have to relate to them.
Yeah, you do. You have to do that modelling, as it were, in order to for things to change. I absolutely agree. Great. Well, we're getting to that stage of the podcast, as I warned you before we started, that I always like to hear what people have been listening to, and then we add it to our playlist, which is a very mixed bag, and it's great that it is. So are there a couple of tracks that you've been interested in lately you want to share?
Yeah, so one of them is for work, and one of them, well, actually, no, they're both for work. I can't say that. But the first is I've been actually comparing a whole load of different recordings of César Franck's three chorales for something I'm doing for Radio 3. And it's been so fascinating to listen to these historical recordings. There's an amazing, I think it's an LP by de Messier, of her playing the three chorales, and it's incredibly exciting playing with that bit of grit that you get from a record that's been sort of made into a digital recording. So that would be my first one. And then the other thing that I came across quite recently, and I've ended up listening to it on repeat, is a sort of cycle by Cheryl Frances Hoad called Even You Song. And it is sort of, it's designed to be like a service of Evensong. But there are these two organ voluntaries that frame it, and they are such cool pieces. So they're both based on the same theme, quite loosely. Ba-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And then the first one is very kind of pre-Evensong. Anyone who's been to a service of Evensong will instantly recognise it as that pre-service music. And the last one is this huge piece, and after this massive build-up, it goes to this tiny, really quiet chord that comes out of this huge sound, and then you get that da 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 da, and then it goes. And there's a huge chord that finishes it off. It's such an exciting piece of music. So that's my other one, I think.
Brilliant, thank you. Oh, well, they sound marvellous. And just as we're heading towards Christmas, is there a really Christmassy organ piece?
There is. Yes. Yeah, there's. I'm sorry, this is not a piece in the best taste, but it's this piece called
No judgment at all, seriously.
The Toccata Gigue on the Sussex Carol by a composer called George Baker, who was actually a dentist as well as being an organist. Not the classic combination, I don't think. But it's such a cool piece. It's based on, obviously, ba-dum, ba-da-da-da-da-da. But then it draws in all sorts of different carols into the mix, and it's kind of like a big French improvisation. And does the same thing, in fact, of dropping back to almost nothing just before the end, so everyone applauds at the wrong point, which is always quite fun.
Brilliant. Excellent. That's going in. I just wanted to contribute one of my own. Actually, I thought I'd choose a piece of organ music just because, Your Honour. And this is one that it was played at my wedding, which was a long time ago. But it was in December, and it was, so the anniversary's just passed. And it was a friend of ours who was an organist. And it was a kind of contemplative piece right in the middle of the service, and it was Jean Alain's Jardin Suspendu, just sumptuous. And I think his sister recorded it, didn't she, who was an organist. And it's, I've always loved it. It's so sort of meditative and got this wonderful harmonies, hasn't it? I mean, it's just, it's beautiful. And just other end of the scale, because it's coming up for Christmas, one of my favourite Christmas songs is Eartha Kitt's Santa Baby, so that's going in.
Oh, well, have you heard the Jonas Kaufmann Christmas album, crucially?
I haven't yet, no. Oh. I'm saving that treat. Is it as people say?
It's just, it puts a smile on your face, okay. Let's say that.
Wonderful. Great, well, this has been really fun to have this conversation, and thank you very much indeed for responding to my invitation to come on the podcast. It's been really great to hear from you.
Not at all, thank you for having me. It's been good fun.
Great, bye for now.